the Reagan presidency, one name has continued to come up in conversations with others who served in that administration. Everyone has said the one person you should be sure to bring to your oral history is Senator Paul Laxalt. He was U.S. Senator from Nevada from 1974 to 1986. He holds degrees, undergraduate and law, from Denver University. He's been a district attorney, a city attorney, lieutenant governor, and governor of Nevada, a fellow governor at that time with Ronald Reagan. He served faithfully and with great dignity in the Senate, but in addition was perhaps Ronald Reagan's closest friend and confidant, and that was symbolized in this historic trip that he made to discuss the change in government in the Philippines with Mr. Marcos. There are many more things one could say: law firms with which he's served, honors which he's received, but all of you have followed most of that, and we count it a high privilege to welcome Senator Laxalt to Mr. Jefferson's academical village.
Thank you very kindly, Ken. I guess many things could be said about Ken Thompson. From my own experience, I'd say he's a study in persistence. We've been attempting, Ken, to put this together for, what, 3 or 4 years, probably, at least. And I must say that my not having come earlier shouldn't be interpreted as any reluctance to come back to this beautiful place. I've had occasion over the years, particularly when I was in the Senate, to come here to speak to some of your students, and many of them here, as well as many of the people in this area, constituted the base of the Reagan candidacy starting way back in 1976. We had occasion this morning to fly here, thanks to Tom Worrell, who's an old friend of mine, by helicopter from Dulles Airport. And I must say it was a magnificent trip. What a wonderful time in Virginia. We'll be peaking, I guess, in a couple of weeks, and that should be a glorious event here. I happened to be one of you. When I left the Senate, my wife and I had to decide what we're going to do with our post-senatorial life. And of course, as Ken indicated, we came originally from Nevada and the West, and we loved that. But we decided, both of us, that we would spend our future years here in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. So as a result, we have a home in McLean. I have a wonderful little country home, and Carol joins me occasionally. She's not as countrified as I, in the Shenandoah above Front Royal. So as I've told John Warner, Chuck Robb, and anybody else who listen, I'm well established as a Virginian and proud to be so. In discussing what I was going to say today, I mentioned to Ken that having people like Howard Baker and Ed Meese and others here, I'm certain that those have presented the policy positions and the structural positions in relation to the Reagan presidency to you very well. And what I'd like to do for a few moments, and we'll throw this open thereafter for questions and answers, is to give you the benefit of my unique perspective in having been very close to Ronald Reagan for a long while, both personally and politically, as to what made him tick, going all the way back to the California days, the 76 presidential campaign, which wasn't all that successful, but in other respects was, the 1980 and 84, and conclude that with some general observations about the Reagan presidency. And thereafter, I will, as I said, throw it open for questions and answers. I first became exposed to Ronald Reagan on a personal political basis way back in 1964. And that was at the time of the Goldwater candidacy for presidency. An exercise in futility in the minds of many, many people, but not in mine. At the time, I was a very young lieutenant governor in Nevada, and I was the first public official in the West to publicly commit for Ronald Reagan, or excuse me, for Barry Goldwater. During the course of that campaign, I had occasion to speak at an event in California at which Ronald Reagan was also a speaker. In my own mind at that time, he had no public persona. He was an actor with whom I had enjoyed greatly, particularly as the Gipper, and being an avid football fan, and I must say you must all be very proud of what your boys are doing. To have University of Virginia number one in football, I think, is a glorious development. I hope it hasn't corrupted you completely in your academic areas. I suspect it hasn't. But in any event, that was the only identification I had with Ronald Reagan at the time. And he made a speech and made it well. And my original impression was that he was a fine man and a wonderful actor and of questionable political substance. And I think probably that was a view shared by most at the time. And it was during that campaign that he came into national attention, if you'll all remember, with a magnificent television speech, some 1.5 hour in duration. And it was done in Los Angeles, and probably the most exciting thing during the course of the whole Goldwater campaign. And whether he realized it or not, he then came to the attention of many prominent political types in California, as well as throughout the country, who insisted in 1965 that he run for governor of California. He had difficulty with that decision because he really hadn't thought in terms of being a candidate, although he enjoyed politics. Many of his old actor friends tell me that in their acting days that he constantly talked politics, and most of them weren't politically oriented, so they considered his constant political interest to be somewhat of a drag and a bore. Nonetheless, he too persisted. And in 1966, he decided to run for governor. And I, at the same time, decided to run for governor of Nevada. So we had parallel campaigns, kept track of one another, and we were both elected. During the course of our governorships, we had many problems in common being adjoining states. And we had, among others, a huge problem in connection with Lake Tahoe, which is a magnificent area, at the time being overdeveloped. And we were fearful lest Lake Tahoe, that magnificent international jewel, turn gray during our watch, which many of the ecologists told us was a distinct possibility. So if you can believe it, two staunch conservatives decided that the only way out of the morass is for us to create a huge metropolitan agency covering both states, which would be an umbrella over Tahoe, and we did that. And as a result of that, Tahoe today is preserved, and it isn't overdeveloped, and we both, I think, are rather proud of that as a matter of history. During that period of time, he, of course, came to national attention and did a lot of exciting things in a most difficult state to govern. I would think then, as now, there are very few states that are complex politically with as many gnawing problems as California has. And he approached it aggressively, and I thought, interestingly, because he approached them as a citizen politician. He proceeded immediately to slash programs right and left. He incurred the animosity. Most of the university structure in California wasn't exactly a darling of them during the 60s. It wasn't all that safe to go with Ronald Reagan to any California campus. for that matter, wasn't safe for many of the rest of us either. But nonetheless, he continued on that course, and particularly on the spending side. He had, at that time, what many of us feel the President of the United States should have. It was called a line item veto. And I saw him employ that hundreds of times and saved the people of California literally billions of dollars utilizing that weapon. And they were to the point, finally, when he started, that they had a very difficult fiscal situation during the course of his governorship, and thereafter they were to the point where there were actually refunds made. Remarkable, just absolutely remarkable. I left politics at the end of 4 years as governor, and feeling I should do other things, and he continued on and remained as governor of California for the remaining 4 years, from 1970 to 1974. I remained in contact, and I kept an eye on him, but we weren't all that close. In 1974, I decided to get back into politics and ran for the United States Senate in the Watergate year. I had a remarkable sense of political timing. That was interesting, but somehow I made it. And in 1974, as you'll all remember, Gerald Ford was the president, who had succeeded to the presidency under the most difficult of circumstances and was doing an admirable job. At that time, many of the Reagan people, many of the conservatives throughout the country felt that while Gerald Ford had been a very effective caretaker president, that in terms of the long range and even in terms of a re-election, that he probably wouldn't be a strong enough candidate. So as a result, many people solicited Ronald Reagan for the purpose of considering a run in 1976 for the presidency. Now you can imagine the heartburn that created in many, many circles, because to run against an incumbent sitting president in either party simply isn't done. It's tacky, and it's politically dangerous if you don't make it. And I must say that when I went back to Washington originally in 1974, I had in mind that while the Reagan people, his close associates in California, felt he should run for president, he did have an abortive run in 1968 in Miami, which was very amateurish and didn't go anywhere, that he really wasn't in the presidential league. But I must also say, the longer I was in Washington and saw the so-called big leaguers, the better Ronald Reagan looked to me, because I found that they were very human, and for the most part, for the most overwhelming part, they didn't have the charisma and appeal and the conviction that Ronald Reagan had. This all finally ended up in a dinner in the Madison Hotel in 1975. And at that time, there were just four or five of us there with Ronald Reagan, considering whether or not he should look at a presidential run. And I've often hearkened back to that, because the Reagan presidency really started with that dinner. And it illustrated to me what can happen in this country, as complex and as overwhelming as it sometimes seems politically, if you get a small handful of people with enough conviction to even seek the presidency. He decided that he would not commit at that time to run for the presidency. He wanted to look. He wanted a feasibility study. I guess as a product of his General Electric days, he probably had a business perspective about how to approach a problem like this. So he commissioned several of us and asked me to head it up, to search around the country and in Washington and see, number one, whether or not a Reagan candidacy would be divisive to the Republican Party. Didn't want to get involved in any effort that was going to be unduly divisive. because he believed strongly in a two-party system. And he had become a very dedicated Republican, particularly as governor of California. Well, we made some samplings around the country and came to the conclusion that if the candidacy was performed in a positive way, it needn't be divisive. And eventually that report was made to him and he decided to run. In 1976, I think the Ford-Reagan primary was probably one of the most civilized I've ever seen in any level. They're both gentlemen. There were no slashing personal attacks of the type that you see now, when negative campaigning and negative advertising has become, unfortunately, the vogue. And they both presented to the Republicans of this country their various views of how the presidency should be conducted in the future. We finally came down to the wire, some of you may remember, ahead of the convention, and neither side had the requisite number to lock up the nomination in advance of the convention. And there were about 100 delegates out there floating around who were eventually going to make the difference. And I can remember full well our being in competition with those delegates, and it really wasn't a fair competition because President Ford, utilizing the White House as he well should, were inviting people, delegates, and having them picked up in limousines and brought to the White House and have visits in the Oval Office and the Roosevelt Room. And if they want a little reception in the East Room, that could be arranged too. Well, we were losing that race into the devil a hurry because people like Ronald Reagan and the rest of us calling delegates just wasn't doing it. So we came to the conclusion we needed to do something very exciting lest the race be locked up. And it was finally decided that what he needed, and this was unprecedented, was a bride, a vice presidential bride, and preferably someone who was in the heart of the areas where the undecided delegates were. And in that particular year, as many years, you have a lot of people in the larger eastern, northeastern states, like New Jersey and Pennsylvania, New York, they love to stay loose, because they eventually become brokers. And this is where the bulk of them were. So we finally decided that we would solicit Richard Swiker, who was my seatmate in the United States Senate, from Pennsylvania as a running mate in advance. So we went to him, and of course he was shocked, but flattered and consented. And in one of the more exciting press conferences I've ever seen in my life in the Capitol, it was announced that Richard Swiker was going to be the vice presidential running mate for Ronald Reagan. And I think probably the consternation, since Richard Swiker had an image at the time, because of the constituency he has of being somewhere left to center, and the consternation particularly among my conservative colleagues. I remember particularly well Strom Thurmond coming up and said, "But Paul, Swike is a liberal." So we proceeded, I think, with that rather bold move to at least unsettle the situation so that these remaining delegates say, "Hey, listen, you know, maybe we better wait until the convention before we commit." And that's essentially what happened. And we went into the convention, and in my judgment, the most exciting convention by far that I've ever participated in, because it went right down to the wire, dead even. Everybody fighting for every delegate. Democracy at its best. And we had a test vote in which we lost, narrowly. And I'll never forget Dick Swiker the next morning coming up and saying that he had examined the vote, and he came to the conclusion that the reason Ronald Reagan might not prevail is because of him, that there were some defections, particularly in the southern states, and Mississippi in particular, and he thought it'd be better if he withdrew from the ticket to give Ronald Reagan a better chance. And without a moment's hesitation, Ronald Reagan said, no, we came on this together and we're going out together, which was a moment of truth, and I thought, you know, reflected the character and integrity of one Ronald Reagan as well as Richard Swigert. Well, of course, we went on, and finally, and Gerald Ford was nominated, and all of us pitched in to help him. And as you'll recall, he was narrowly defeated by Jimmy Carter. After that convention, I think the Reagans, and remember, he was in his late 60s then, and most people felt that people in their late 60s weren't viable for any public office, and particularly the presidency. And I think both he and Nancy felt that was, they'd run the string and that was it. I implored them to stay loose because they'd made a very, very positive impression, not only among Republicans, but upon the country. And that they should stay loose because politics was unpredictable and politics was cyclical, and who knows what would happen. Even though political truism is and was then that if a sitting president did a good job, it was ordinarily 8 years. And 8 years would be out of the question. And I'll remember full well attending my first meeting with President Carter as a senator, and it was weeks into the Carter presidency. And it was apparent to me early, as decent a man as he was and as competent he was in some areas, he just didn't have it. He just didn't relate. He didn't even come close to relating to us as senators, not that that was the test. So I made it a point that very day to call Ronald Reagan, and I said, you know, I think, Ron, I've just met a one-term president. And I'd advise you strongly to not make any public Sherman-esque type statements that you're not going to run. I think probably the climate's going to be such, depending on future developments, where you may be a viable candidate in 1980. And he did that. And eventually, as you know, he decided to run and conducted a tremendous campaign in 1980, although it wasn't easy. We had developed a team in 1976 of certain pros and, of course, kept them on in 1980. But some of them tactically, I think, weren't up to the 1980 race, in particularly Iowa. Ronald Reagan, as many of you may know, had his roots in that Illinois-Iowa area as a young man, and spent much of his youth after graduation from college as a sports announcer in Des Moines. So the political pros felt that he didn't have to spend much time in Iowa. He should be spending his time in other more important states. George Bush was running then. He practically lived in Iowa for months, adopted an Iowa strategy. And to the complete shock of the whole political community in this country, and particularly the Reagan forces, beat Ronald Reagan in Iowa. And I think in all probability that awoke the Reagan forces to the point where they felt that they'd better rewrite the ball game, get some new people on board, and go forward. And I'll never forget in New Hampshire, at a debate in a small school auditorium in Nashua, which was scheduled for both then George Bush and then Governor Reagan. And there were several other candidates at the time, Howard Baker, Phil Crane, several others. But the stars really were the two. And they developed a parliamentary struggle as to whether or not Ronald Reagan was to speak first or George Bush and whatever. And the moderator turned off the mic on Ronald Reagan. And during the format, the Reagan forces had paid essentially for the costs of the whole event. And Ronald Reagan grabbed the mic and said, Mr. Green, I refuse to be turned off. I paid for the mic. it was explosive, and it was just off the cuff, and it showed the fighting spirit that you never saw of a Ronald Reagan. It was amazing psychologically, because I think that little 15-second outburst completely broke the logjam as far as Ronald Reagan was concerned in New Hampshire and the rest of the country. And in New Hampshire, he had a convincing victory over George Bush, and later that translated into a victory. Not all that easy, because the people who had been conducting the campaign, if you can believe it, had acted like political sultans for the first several months. We had $18 million, I think, allocated that we could spend during that primary. And of the $18 million after New Hampshire, we found that they had spent 12. So that meant we had $6 million for the whole rest of the country, for the whole remainder of the campaign, with George Bush still then a very viable and well-financed candidate. In desperation, we went to a fellow by the name of Bill Casey, whom I'd never known, who apparently was power in financial circles in New York and had been in the Nixon administration, was well respected as a hardball man who could watch a dollar and also was a good political strategist. So he was brought on board pretty much in desperation at the personal request of the Reagans. And Bill Casey, in my estimation, was magnificent in the manner in which he handled it. His public persona was zip, probably a minus. You couldn't understand a word that Case said. You know, we always used to say after, we never need a scrambler when he was head of the CIA because you couldn't understand him. But he grabbed hold of that campaign, watched and nursed every nickel, minimum of television advertising. And I'll bet you that if you could compute the cost of a political campaign and the expeditious use of presidential money, nothing would ever match that campaign. And we went through the whole rest of that campaign in huge states, didn't waste any money, cut our workforces, relied on volunteers, which is not in vogue anymore, and proceeded to have a wonderful race, and as we all know, in an unprecedented landslide. As a matter of fact, the Reagans that evening, about 5 o'clock, California time, were preparing to go to dinner with some friends to bring in the election. And as Ronald Reagan says, he was in the shower when Jimmy Carter called and conceded. So that was a unprecedented race and an unprecedented victory as far as Ronald Reagan is concerned. In 1984, he ran against Mr. Mondale, with whom I'd served in the Senate, magnificent man, represented, I think, an ideology which is not acceptable at the time to most Americans. And despite the fact that Reagan had seemingly everything going for him in terms of being an incumbent president, strong political organization, and at least on a par with Mr. Mondale in the fundraising area, almost fumbled the campaign in one of the worst events that I've ever seen politically, and it occurred in Kentucky. The Reagan-Mondale debate in Kentucky was a total unmitigated disaster. Ronald Reagan stumbled through it. It wasn't responsive. His closing statement was abysmal. And it was sad. And immediately, this could be very, very destructive. Why? Because an awful lot of people say, well, he's been a wonderful man, but he's over the hill. He's had 4 years, and he's over the hill, and his performance, his abject performance during the course of his debate is proof positive that he is over the hill. Many of us examined what happened, and we came to the conclusion that Ronald Reagan had been brutalized by being overtrained, put him in sessions like this, in mock sessions on a debate, and you had people like Stockman being Mondale all over his head and into his face, as the kids now say, loaded his head with numbers to the point that when he went into Kentucky He was had a psychological straitjacket on him. It performed miserably. So we decided for the second debate that they would be played differently. And we didn't get into the brutalizing sessions at all. We discussed issues generally around a table. We didn't have any time limitations on it. We didn't stuff any statistics into his head. And lo and behold, the second debate with Mr. Mondale, the old Ronald Reagan emerged once again, and he performed magnificently, and all that had been lost was retrieved. And I'll never forget, near the end of the campaign, when it was apparent that Ronald Reagan was going to win and win easily, every poll revealed that, and we were up in the upper Midwest, and the people on the plane said that they had received responses from Minnesota asking he'd go in there to show what kind of a gentleman he is. He says, "I really don't want to go into Minnesota because that's Mr. Mondale's home area, and I'd rather not go in there at all." And this is after Fritz had been in California and with no trepidation whatsoever had really worked over one Ronald Reagan. And on the weekend before the election, I'll never forget, the requests were such throughout the Minnesota that they absolutely insisted that he come in there, however briefly. So we threw together a brief airport appearance and let the word out an hour before in Minnesota by radio that Ronald Reagan was going to come to this isolated rural airport. And as we flew in, I couldn't believe it. There were trucks coming in from every country road for miles around, and automobiles and everything. And on 1 hour's notice, there were over 10,000 people there to greet Ronald Reagan. And he made a very gracious speech in Minnesota. And as it developed, Minnesota and the district were the only states that he didn't carry. A very convincing victory, to say the least. The Reagan presidency and its evaluation and characterization, I will leave for the historians, because my views are somewhat biased. But I think certain observations can be made concerning it. First of all, that outsiders who are identified as citizen politicians, if properly handled, and if they have the qualities requisite to become a candidate, even in these modern, sophisticated days, can realistically aspire to be elected President of the United States. And that makes me, as a citizen, feel somewhat reassured. Because for all intents and purposes, from the beginning, Ronald Reagan was not a politician. Not that I consider that to be bad, but he was always a citizen, basically, who got into politics on a short-term, temporary basis. He also demonstrated that the power of the presidency in terms of its being a bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt used to say, was absolutely awesome, properly utilized. I was impressed, having been inside the Reagan presidency, how limited a president is as a practical matter, as a force, politically. Because the plain unvarnished fact of the matter, and I don't want to be cynical about this, it's really in the administrative areas, it's almost irrelevant who president of the United States is, because the careerists run it, the bureaucrats run it. They see presidents come and go, and they do their thing without regard to whoever is president and whatever that philosophy may be in the main. And that's not bad, because most of the people in the administrative areas, first of all, are very qualified and very dedicated, and I think they do their job in their own way. But in the policy areas, where you really have to energize the country in dealing with Congress, the presidency can be an enormously effective bully pulpit. And this is where Reagan's strength was. Because I can remember in the old days that the Congress then was as recalcitrant as it is now. They simply are new breed post-Watergate, and they simply don't go simply because the president wants them to go or because the leadership wants to go. They're motivated more out of fear than they are persuasion. And while Reagan very often couldn't convince them on given major policy issues of perhaps he was right or wrong, they dare not cross him because he'd get on television and appeal to their constituencies and build up enormous constituent pressure. The mail and telephone calls that he was able to engender through his public appearance was absolutely awesome. On issue after issue, I saw him change the complexion of Congress on key votes because he had that capability. Now, admittedly, toward the end, because of the Iran-Contra situation, that power diminished, and I think his influence as a result diminished greatly. But I think that he proved that the presidency as a bully pulpit can be an extremely effective place. Lastly, I think that whatever you may say about Reagan and his record, and however you may feel philosophically, that he had a basic adherence to conviction and principle on a rather simplistic basis, which showed and eventually worked. Because he came to the people in the country with a very simple platform. The Washington was too expensive, that the size of the federal government, if it can't be effectively reduced, should be checked and restrained to permit state and local governments to grow more. That the people are overtaxed and we should have tax cuts. And if you had tax cuts, this would promote eventually the overall economy. And above all, that we are in a tenuous place in respect to the Soviets. And that the only way to deal effectively with the Soviets was to build an effective defense force. And that one day, if we did that, particularly with something like SDI, they would come to the table. And I think probably history has to indicate that his basic principles at the time were valid and that he was effective enough to be able to carry them out. Now, there are many who feel that with the events of the last several months that Ronald Reagan hasn't been given due credit, particularly for what's happened in Eastern Europe and what's happened in the Soviet Union. And that may or may not be true, and I guess, again, history will call that one way or the other. As far as he's concerned, it's not a problem for him. He's basically unselfish anyhow, but I had occasion to visit with him this last weekend out in Los Angeles. He had just returned from a trip to Eastern Europe and to Berlin. And I don't think he much cares about what people generally think in terms of his recognition or what the historians even are going to say about it. Based upon his own experience, he knows that the people there recognize and appreciate what he's done for them. His staff tells me that in Berlin, when he was at the wall, and wherever he went in the Soviet Union, the people absolutely lionized him and gave him complete credit, substantial credit for the fact that they had been liberated. And they so indicated to him, and I have never seen him as appreciative of his efforts in public life as he is now. So for an old friend like me and associates, that's reassuring, because very often politics doesn't turn out that way. So much, Ken, for the formal remarks. I'd be happy to field any questions that you may have in relation to what I've said or outside, whatever.
Who would like to ask the first question?
Yes, sir.
Senator Laxalt, you've spoken a couple of times of Reagan's age. And I wondered if you could tell us what changes you observed over your 25 years of acquaintance in Mr. Reagan's recent memory and his level of energy, his capacity for sustained concentration and activity, and how those changes, if any, affected his function not so much as a campaigner, but as the chief executive?
I don't know in terms of his physical energy, in terms of his alertness, that there's been any fundamental change. He's one of the few people I know that is virtually ageless. He suffers from a hearing problem, which I think at times serves him well. I noticed particularly this last time that they got into debates or discussions around the table that he wasn't particularly interested in. He'd sort of turn off, and I know what had happened. But he essentially was a delegator. So he didn't have to be a nitty-gritty type of person. You know what I mean? During the time that we were governors together, I was absolutely amazed how much he'd delegate out. Absolutely amazed. I couldn't do that. I had to know what was going on in my shop. I don't know whether I was nosy or curious I just didn't have that degree of confidence. So it wasn't required for him in terms of administration to have the degree of alertness that one normally would, although I'm sure that he did. The same thing happened in the White House. He delegated most everything out and never looked back. And for the most part, it served him well. It blew up on him in Iran-Contra because he didn't know what was going on in the basement. And he should have. In those last days, in the Iran-Contra period, I sensed that he was hurt because he received criticism from the people, and he always received it from certain quarters of the press, but from the people who in poll after poll indicated they didn't believe him. That hurt him to the core. So, as I say, in summary, I haven't seen any real fundamental change in him in terms of his energy. He's really energetic even now. He's maybe 80 years old in February. And mentally, he's positive, alert, and I think above all, passive and serene. And what a joy after all the tumultuous years they have to be approaching 80 years old and be at peace. And he's always been fundamentally so because he's fundamentally kind and gentle. In the raucous, difficult world of Washington politics, I can remember session after session when people really close very often appeared to betray him. And he'd always be able to look at the positive side of that situation and always give that person who was on the block at the time the benefit of the doubt. Even Dave Stockman, Dave Stockman really turned him around. And not only going to oppress a person during difficult days, but also giving that person derogatory information about how wrong he felt Ronald Reagan was in terms of economic policy. And even in those days when many around him, including me, felt that Dave should go, not into the woodshed, but into oblivion, because you can't tolerate that at that level, he still had a kind word for David. So I think that probably that showed, as far as the people are concerned, I think it was a subtle quality that made Ronald Reagan one of our most popular presidents. Yes, sir.
Henry Theobart. Yep.
One of our speakers last week said that he felt that the FBI situation was the final contributing factor that made the Russians throw in the sponge because they find it very difficult and it was impossible to keep up. Do you think that's what we're seeing?
No, I don't. I agree with it completely. And I'm personally convinced that the Soviets never would have come back to the table in Geneva if it hadn't been for the fact that it was clear that Reagan was going forward aggressively with SDI. I don't think any of us can over-exaggerate the importance and the effect of SDI and the overall geopolitical consideration of the Soviet. And I think probably if there was a crowning point in the Reagan presidency in terms of security, it's probably SDI. And I'll never forget the first speech that he made in connection with SDI. He was derided, certainly by the press, and even within the Congress. They're calling it Star Wars, and you know, Reagan's really lost it this time. And yet the people around him felt that this was the real answer to illustrate not only to the Soviet, but to the third world nuts that we were going to build our own protective defense against nuclear problems. And I would hope, even though the record of the Congress the last few days hasn't been all that reassuring, I would hope above all things that we continue to try to do what we can with SDI. Because even if the Soviet threat is substantially removed, I personally feel in the years to come, as far as those who follow, the greatest threat we're going to have is nuclear capability in the hands of third world nuts like Saddam Hussein. You know, we just can't leave ourselves with that kind of vulnerability. SDI, I think, was critical in terms of what eventually happened.
Wilson, then.
Senator, thank you for coming. While you were in the House, Mr. Jefferson built, having in mind that it was his belief that our documents, governing documents, should be reviewed from time to time. And picking up on your own statement, the dichotomy between the politician and the citizen, I would like to ask whether, based on your experience, which is virtually unparalleled, what your opinion is and what you have reason to believe President Reagan's opinion is concerning the effectiveness of the nominating process of vice presidents.
That probably stayed a question too long, Ken. I think it's all right. I suppose a case could be made that the vice presidency, the race, should be separate and isolated. And as the races are for lieutenant governor in many states. But as far as I'm concerned, it seems to me the most important consideration in terms of the vice presidency for the president is that he have someone there whom he feels is going to replace him well in the event that the unmentionable should happen. And secondly, a person with whom he's going to have complete trust and confidence in terms of security and very confidential matters. Now, if you throw the process open, which is appealing from a democratic standpoint, fine, you have someone else who's elected independently by the people, not really appointed by the president, blessed by the convention. I think what you could end up doing is having you'd have a team on top which would be basically incompatible, certainly personally and perhaps politically, and I don't think that would be good. Well, I assume that.
You referred to the significance of the selection of a vice president and Senator Weicker.
Swiker, yes.
Was selected.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the point being? In terms of the present situation, Danny Quayle, I must tell you, is a friend. And really, as a younger senator, when I had been around a while, was one of my political proteges. And I'll never forget being in New Orleans on the night before the selection, and we'd all had dinner together, and at that time he, among others, was being mentioned, and he came up to me and he said, "Geez, I'm getting a pretty good ride in my home state, being mentioned for vice president." And he asked me, he said, "Do you think I got a shot?" I said, "Oh, Dan, no way." And but I think, in fairness to Dan, that the manner in which that was handled really hurt him grievously from the very beginning. The first impression that you get in this country, particularly with that tube, is critical. And once that impression is created, it's almost impossible to correct it. And look what happened in the Quayle situation. They weren't notified. They weren't conditioned. I mean, the day that came down, they had to find Danny in Maryland. And he was absolutely shocked. And within minutes was thrust into a national situation where he'd just been told, "This, my God, I've been selected to be vice president." And he appeared on that first show as a young cheerleader, didn't he? He was so hyped up and so enthusiastic. I don't think that was fair to him. I don't think it was fair to him at all. I think that it wasn't critical. George was pandering really to the press and keeping suspense in the convention where he didn't have to. I think Danny should have been told the first of the week. He should have been conditioned. He should have been primed so that he wasn't set out there as a cold candidate. And I think probably that wasn't fair to him. And I think it's been a very, very important factor why he's had the difficulties he's had in this country. And I hearken back to the fact, and I proceed on a premise that he's basically competent, which I believe him to be, that had he had a little bit of conditioning, that the first impression of the country would have been entirely different than it was depicted. Yes? No, I really don't. I wish I could tell you that I thought so. And the ironic thing about it is that the line item veto in the United States Senate was not harpooned by Democrats, it was harpooned principally by Republicans. And the leader of the opposition, the Republicans, was not only a respected United States Senator, but a former governor who in his state had the line item veto and exercised it many times. You know who it was? Mark Hatfield. Mark Hatfield led the fight against it. And he did it very effectively. And he made the point and the distinction that it's a lot different in giving the right of line item veto to a governor of a state as opposed to the president's. He said, in the right hands, he said, "I'd be perfectly comfortable giving that power and authority to Ronald Reagan because I don't think that power and authority would be abused by Ronald Reagan." But he says, "I can think of presidents in recent memory where I wouldn't want them to have that power. And I wouldn't want them calling me in on a key vote and say, 'Senator Hatfield, if you don't go along with me on this key vote, I got this line item veto pen waiting for your next favorite project.'" And I think he convinced a lot of the undecideds that perhaps as appealing as line item veto is, and regardless how well it works in some states, and certainly Reagan was a good example of that, perhaps it's a little dangerous on the federal level. Yes?
Senator, over the time of Reagan years, it has seemed to me that the increasing, I think, TV practice of the instant analysis coming on right after any televised campaign or any major speech by the president.
Not an unmixed blessing.
Do you have a view on the growth of that TV practice?
Well, I'm not a real fan of political people in television because I find most of them be totally devoid of any substance, too often looking to the sensationalistic elements of covering an event and certainly analyzing it. But I don't frankly know what you can do about it. They're a fact of life. I like to think that the thoughtful people basically still control the process. And thoughtful people are not going to be swayed by people coming up as instant experts and dissecting a State of the Union speech in 30 seconds for a sound bite. And that thoughtful people are going to be reading thoughtful periodicals and newspapers and conducting thoughtful discussions about themselves, and they eventually are going to influence policy. That was the case in the Reagan effort. When I look back at the people who became policy factors, these were thoughtful people. I mean, Jean Kirkpatrick came off of campus. She wasn't any television star. And it was because of her writing she came to the attention of President Reagan and became a forceful factor in the Reagan administration. I think that most presidents recognize the distinction between entertainment and substance. Television gives you entertainment, but not much substance. And I would think most presidents, when they come down to the basic policy decisions, are going to be more substantive in their approach for advice. I hope so. Yes.
During the 1984 debates, I have two questions. First, why did Reagan give Mondale the opportunity to debate and really the opportunity to play catch a ball? Secondly, in the second debate, Reagan jokingly pointed out Mondale's youth and inexperience, and it was really considered the stalker in the debate. Was that
the way that it eventually came off is extemporaneous, but within general parameters on the debate preparation, it was felt that he somehow should meet that and meet it, if he could, in a jocular fashion. So within those general parameters, the response came off the top. And he's good at that. In the Carter debate, if you remember, there you go again. Isn't it sad that just one little clause off the top is determinative of a substantive debate, but that's the way it is. Same thing in the Nashua debate with George Bush. George did very well in that debate as a matter of substance, but everyone forgot about it when Reagan grabbed the mic. In terms of why he went into the debate with Mondale, he believes in public discourse. And many within the campaign framework felt he shouldn't dignify and give Mondale that kind of coverage. Many did, because they felt he was that strong. He's the one to call that shot. And there were many also, curiously enough, particularly the so-called political Pauls, who had no faith in Ronald Reagan in that kind of situation. They honestly felt he wasn't up to it. And they forget the fact that in debates and forums of that kind, that when it comes down to the scorecard, it's probably 1 point on substance and about 9 points on style. And no one could beat Ronald Reagan on style. And even in the substantive areas, he constantly surprised. One of the great battles I had all the time with the so-called political experts was to let Reagan be Reagan. They were just afraid of letting him get out on his own. Just totally afraid of it. They didn't have any real faith in him. You know why? Because they didn't consider him to be a professional politician, which was his greatest strength. I'll never forget in 1976, and we were in North Carolina, and this is after Reagan had been defeated by Gerald Ford in New Hampshire, blew that race, because he, again, on the advice of political Pauls, was told he had New Hampshire in his pocket, so he leaves the weekend before the election, if you can believe it, goes to Illinois, because that's where all the votes were. Loses New Hampshire by less than 1,000 votes, and very quickly not only lost Illinois, but lost Florida. and then lost, it was Florida, and then we were in North Carolina where it was do or die. And one of the great conflicts that we had within the whole effort was whether or not Ronald Reagan should take advantage of being once a film actor. And the experts, and I won't give you names, but you can guess who they were at the time, some inherited from the old Nixon effort, constantly wanted to apologize, literally apologize for the fact that Ronald Reagan at one time had been a film actor. They felt somehow that detracted from the seriousness that a presidential candidate should have. And they prevailed until North Carolina. And that gets to be desperation time, right? You've tried everything else, it isn't working. So we finally brought a team out of his old buddies. And I remember they were headed by Jimmy Stewart. And from the time that Jimmy Stewart and the Hollywood crowd came onto the Reagan campaign, it transformed the campaign, the chemistry, immediately. They added a dimension to the Reagan campaign you could have otherwise. So the fact of the matter is that the political polls didn't recognize that politicians per se are dull as hell, and political events are dull. They are. Unless you're a political junkie, they're dull. And in these various events, starting in North Carolina and elsewhere, as soon as we brought in the Reagan friends from the film colony, unbelievable. We even had Jimmy emceeing them. And we had gatherings of, as the campaign progressed in the Midwest, where we would jam places with 2,000 or 3,000 people in smaller areas where normally you'd have a few hundred and be happy to have them. So it's proof positive, I think, of the fact that the political professionals tend to be very myopic when it comes to seeing the total picture in determining the value of a candidate. Yes, sir.
Great admirer of Ronald Reagan, but there is some concern about the deficit that he has bequeathed to us. Wasn't the potential magnitude recognized? And if so, were there any policy initiatives that may have tried?
Well, of course, if you asked him that question, he'd say that if they'd have followed his budget recommendations, that they'd be in balance now. Which is open to some question, because others would say if you took the Reagan budgets as submitted, we'd still have huge deficit problems. He honestly felt that by going the supply side route, the first thing you do is deprive the politicians in Washington from wasting that much more money, and you'd have it out in the private sector, and that would regenerate the economy. And I suppose the fact that we've had this run, the most historic run of economic growth in our history, might be proof of that. But the fact that we have these huge deficits, I think, presents the biggest problem in the whole Reagan era. Because after all, historically, we honestly felt that if we could come in and exercise the restraints that we could on the spending side, and you couple those with tax incentive to raise the revenues, that all the ships would rise and all would be well. It didn't turn out that way. It simply didn't turn out that way. First of all, the defense costs that we assumed were far more than anybody ever thought. Far more. Because they just burgeoned literally out of sight. And we were never able, for political reasons, to get the kind of cuts out of the Congress that we should. And I'm convinced that as far as cuts are concerned, meaningful cuts on the congressional side, unless we get into a horrid depression where everybody's really got to think in terms of sacrifice, and particularly in the huge entitlement areas, it won't happen. The political price is just too great. Observe the events of the last several days. I mean, the bulk of the spending that we have in this country now, justified or not, the bulk of it, I know the current percentage is, it's got to be 70-75%, I suppose, is in the so-called entitlement areas. That's where all the big money items are. But everybody, with great political justification, is afraid to touch them. I mean, they got into Medicare, flirted with it. It wasn't any heavy. We're just going to have a little increase in the deductible. Look what happened. My Lord, I know what's finally going to happen, but I have a strong suspicion Medicare is not going to be part of that package. If it is, it's going to be very modest. Social Security, I mean, there's the biggest political graveyard in the history of this country, people toy with Social Security. Just don't fool with Social Security. That'll get you licked quicker than anything else. If you don't believe me, you just ask a lot of Republicans in 1982. So I don't know, unless you get some kind of dictatorial front of government, or we just get into a total fiscal morass here of 1930 proportions, where everybody say, hey, everybody's got to cut, and we've got to bring this thing into some semblance of balance, regardless of the political cost. I'm afraid it's not going to happen. And what I hear now is that the discussions that Hubert Humphrey used to tell me, I'll never forget when I first came back as a naive young senator in 1974, had been a balanced budget governor by constitutional responsibility, and I had campaigned on the basis that we ought to be fiscally conservative. And I came back, and the very first budget that Gerald Ford submitted had a deficit of $23 billion. I almost went into cardiac arrest. Oh, to go back to those glorious days. But at then, $23 billion was all the money. Oh, I just couldn't relate to it. And I'll never forget coming back to the Senate chamber, and I ran into Hubert Humphrey, whom I loved, whom I thought was a real political scholar and an honest liberal. Right or wrong, he was an honest liberal, he believed. And he asked me what I was doing about it. So I told him, he said, don't get excited about things like that. Just don't get excited about things like that. You worry about those balance budgets, they don't mean anything. He said, a lot of that money we owe to ourselves anyhow. He says, the real number to keep in your head always is what our debt is in relation to the gross national product. And as a young, naive senator, I said, I have all the respect in the world for you, Mr. Humphrey, but every instinct I have tells me you're wrong. And I still believe that. And yet today, what are you hearing? What are you hearing? These deficits really don't count all that much. And I've heard several times this last month during this budget debate that the amount of the deficits don't really count. Look at the percentage of GNP. Hubert Humphrey revisited. He started looking down, sort of smiling a little. So I don't know. I just don't know. Confusing times. Have I taken up too much time?
Yeah, unless there's one last question that someone has to ask. So Bill O'Dell.
Bill?
Under Ford, the nominations.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
When Ford had taken the nominations.
Yes, sir.
Why did not Mr. Reagan endorse it?
I get that question very often, and it's my distinct recollection, again, if Ronald Reagan was here, Ronald Reagan not only endorsed him, he campaigned for him extensively. I know because I was on some of those trips with him. So there's been an impression created, I think without validity, to the effect that Ronald Reagan backed away from Gerald Ford in that race, and it simply is not true. Just not true, sir.
Well, we knew this was going to be a high point, but not quite this inspiring, so we're terribly grateful, Senator, and we hope you'll come back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.